Welcome to Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Erwin Gratz, along with Mal Leary and Steve Missler. Well, finally, we have an early look at what Maine voters are thinking. Colby College conducted a statewide poll, and it contains some cautionary information for Republican Senator Susan Collins. Mal, why don't you walk us through what the poll showed about our U.S. Senate race?
Well, it was very interesting, Erwin. To begin with, the size of the sample is large for what we usually see in Maine. The sample was 1,008, and it's a combination of landlines, cell phones, and internet inquiries. So they took all of the latest technologies and planning strategies of how to get a good sample and put them together to try to get as good a sample as possible. And what it showed in the Senate race was virtually a dead heat. The margin of error is around 3.5%, and this survey showed Sarah Gideon 1 point up over Collins, 43-42, which means, really, it's a dead heat.
Sarah Gideon, of course, would be the Democratic nominee if she wins her primary.
Correct. They presume that she's going to, because in the numbers that they have in that race, she is just running away from it. She's way up 60%, and then you've got a bunch of folks in single digits. She is presumed in this survey by the pollsters to be the one who's going to be challenging Collins. Now, of course, that may change between now and the primary in June, when the Democrats actually nominate their candidate. But right now, they're looking at this head-to-head race because, quite frankly, these polls are expensive. To reach all those folks we were talking about costs a lot of money. And Colby has made a commitment this year saying that there's not enough polls about what Maine people are thinking, that they're going to do three in state polls. So what we're looking at now is just the first of what's going to be some interesting data as the year goes on.
Yeah, I think the other thing I would add to that is there were some interesting results as it relates to independents. And I think, Mal, when you spoke with Dan Shea, who participated in this poll, he had some interesting things to say about that.
He did. And one of the things, Steve, that's very important here that gets kind of lost is we look at the horse race number, 43-42. But what's more interesting is what are called crosstabs, where the computer can analyze, you know, where Republican women voters are going in a particular race, or where young voters who support a candidate for president are going in the Senate race. So you have this wonderful analysis data. And Dan had a very interesting point to make when it comes to where the independent voters are going in Maine.
About 40% of independent voters said it would make them less likely to vote for Senator Collins. 13% said it would make them more likely they would vote for Senator Collins. You know as well as I do, the key to elections in Maine is the independent voters, really. And if 40% have said that this vote, this singular vote, will make it more likely they'll vote against her, that's a big deal.
So in addition to what Dan says there, there's more bad news for Collins, and it's women voters, specifically women between the age of 18 and 34 are driving her favorability rating underwater. And it's not that much better with women aged 35 to 49. The gap does narrow considerably with women age 50 and older. And it's really interesting because it's hard to imagine Susan Collins being in trouble with women voters or even independent voters 3 years ago, even, you know, before Trump came into office. But it seems as though, whether it's impeachment or her vote for Supreme Court Judge Brett Kavanaugh, the accumulation of her votes and her what she's done during the Trump presidency has really eroded her support with independents, or at least you could deduce that from this poll. And the other thing that's interesting about independents, as we sort of shift to the poll's results as it relates to the Democratic primary, is that there are a good chunk of independents who said that they wanted to register as Democrats this year so that they could vote in the presidential primary.
You know, to the degree that independents particularly might be worried about whether or not Donald Trump will win re-election, people begin to think about Congress as kind of that countervailing power and think to themselves, maybe I'm going to split my ticket this year in order to make sure that Congress controls the president.
That's exactly what you saw happen in the 2018 midterms. which is one reason why Democrats were able to take the House of Representatives. I think there are some voters that are ambivalent about Trump, but perhaps concerned about him, too, to the point where there were swing voters who voted for Democrats in the 2018 election because they wanted to make sure that there was some sort of check on him. Now, of course, we have all seen that Congress is having a very difficult time being an actual check on this president. We saw the impeachment trial and, of course, there's ongoing disputes over just simple turning over of documents as the House tries to perform investigations. Now, those issues will still be ongoing. They are now as we go into November. So it'll be interesting to see if voters who had that on their minds in 2018 will also have that on their minds in 2020 when the president is up for re-election.
Mal?
If you go back to the exit polls from 1996, when she was first elected, she was in a tough race, including against a former governor. And she was able to pull off that victory based on women in the suburban areas of the state. They're the ones that elected her in the first time. So to see this kind of shift over the course of her being in the Senate is pretty dramatic.
Steve Missler, tell us more about what this poll from Colby tells us about the upcoming Democratic presidential primary.
Not big surprises. I mean, I think we talked about this a little bit in last week's segment, but we didn't have the benefit of a poll to basically base our speculation on. What we saw in this poll is that Bernie Sanders, perhaps unsurprisingly, given his dominating victory in 2016, leads the pack of Democratic hopefuls at 25%, followed by Pete Buttigieg at 16%, Mike Bloomberg at 14%, Joe Biden at 12%, and Elizabeth Warren at 9%. And then the rest sort of fall off from there. While Bernie Sanders, you would think that he perhaps would have performed better, voters have more choices this time. You know, that's one issue. And then I think the other issue perhaps is that there's a big division in the among moderate voters and who they go to. There seems to be this one moderate rises and another one falls. I mean, look at what's going on with Biden and Bloomberg. Bloomberg rises and Biden falls. And, you know, given this debate performance we saw from Bloomberg the other night where he just got crushed, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw another moderate sort of start to push him down a little bit, perhaps Pete Buttigieg or even Biden himself, depending on how he does in some of these southern primary states. It's also interesting to see where the support is coming from, too. With Bernie Sanders, he's really being fueled here in Maine, especially by young voters. That's not terribly surprising necessarily because that's where his support is all over the country. And Pete Buttigieg is doing well with women, particularly women over age 50, which is also very interesting because he's also the youngest candidate in the field by far. I mean, he's basically a millennial, yet he can't seem to get any traction with millennial voters. There's been a lot of reporting about this. There are some millennials who just despise this guy for whatever reason. And older voters seem to like him, perhaps because he's the embodiment of what those older voters want their children to be or their grandchildren to be or something. I don't know. With Bloomberg, I noticed, too, that his support seems to be among older men and independents. Also, with Elizabeth Warren, it's hard to say because her support is so scattered. There's certainly a lot of women voters that support her, but she is faced, at least in this poll, with some other obstacles, and it'll be interesting to see whether or not she can overcome those come March 3rd, Super Tuesday.
I think it's also interesting to look at how Maine shakes out compared to the nation. And it's the same thing. You take the progressive left-wing group led by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. They're overwhelmed when you add the numbers together of the moderates, Biden, Bloomberg, Buttigieg. So even though some of the specific subgroups are different, overall, we're in the same position where the moderates are leading when you add them all together versus the progressive wing of the party.
I think the key question is can moderates coalesce around one candidate? I mean, I don't know. I mean, inherently, you think moderates are kind of squishy voters. You know, they could be persuaded on certain issues and whatever. So I don't know if moderates will coalesce behind one candidate or another. I really don't know if that's even possible. But so far, it's not the case. And who benefits from that at the moment? It's Bernie Sanders by far.
For as long as I've been in this state, which is coming up on 42 years, but who's counting, Maine's relations with its Indian tribes have been a fraught issue for its political leaders. The Indian land claim settlement and a legislative act that followed were supposed to better define those relations, but they really haven't. And now there's a bill in the legislature to overhaul the Indian Land Claims Act and better define where state sovereignty ends and where tribal sovereignty begins. Steve Missler, any chance this is actually going to help state-tribal relations?
Well, if the public hearings on that particular bill are any indication, I don't think so. I mean, what we saw have seen over the last several days as this special commission vets this proposal and takes public comment on it, we're at a point where it seems like old wounds are being opened here.
This land deal had a clear intent to limit our sovereignty, and it was an attempt to control us and to keep us dependent on the state of Maine.
At the moment, I don't see a resolution here. I mean, I think the proposal has the backing of a lot of progressive Democrats in the legislature, but notably, it doesn't have the support of Governor Janet Mills. And this is a very big deal for her, honestly, because if we recall and go back to when she was running for governor, her relationships with the tribes was always a key point of friction because as attorney general, she had been drawn into a lot of disputes with the tribe over water fishing rights and a lot of other issues where she became, I don't want to call her an enemy, but she was not looked favorably upon by the tribes because she was basically fighting them in these legal battles. When she became governor, she had a lot of outreach to repair that relationship. But, you know, listening to some of the testimony from some of the members of the tribes as they're going through this hearing, they're very disappointed with her because they feel like these other gestures that she's made, such as replacing Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day and other issues where she's made some gestures to repair these relationships, they see those as superficial. They want this.
We have asked for the rights, privileges, benefits, and immunities enjoyed by other federally recognized tribes across the nation. This is a lot to ask, but it is not too much to ask.
And she is not on board with this particular proposal right now, which doesn't bode well for it passing.
Steve mentioned the fishing rights issue. What else is actually in this bill that's being discussed at the moment, Mal?
I really think you got to do a little bit of history here, okay? I mean, this is a very long process by which most Indian tribes were covered by what's called the Non-Intercourse Act of 1798. Maine tribes were never covered by that. So they felt that they had a legitimate claim, and several legal minds agreed with them, to the land that they had always occupied here in Maine. So they filed this lawsuit. Now, the settlement of the lawsuit is very different from the terms of other Indian law that has been passed by Congress. And you've mentioned fishing rights. That's one of those areas where the Settlement Act gives the state more of an impact on fishing laws than you would find, say, with a tribe out west somewhere. So this is going to be a very difficult knot to untangle because it's been so different. Now, the tribes say, we want what the other tribes have. And that's certainly a legitimate position for them to take. But to get there, you not only have to get the legislature to vote for it, you got to get Congress to vote for it. And if the past is any history here, Congress is going to want the state to work it out with the tribes first before they even begin to look at this issue. The numbers of issues about Indian gaming as part of this would allow the tribes to have slot machines, such as tribes do in other parts of the country. That's always been controversial in this state. It's been defeated at public referendum. So we got an awful lot of issues here, and I just don't see how they can get it done this year. They might get a bill, call it, fix it light or something, where they can set up a few things that people can agree with. But some of these big issues Steve was talking about that have been around for a very long time, they're not going to get resolved very quickly.
On the fishing rights issue, if we go back just a few years, what the state is concerned about are two different sets of regulations, right? And we saw like what that conflict looks like in real life of just a few years ago when the Department of Marine Resources basically came in with tactical teams because they feared that there were tribal members that were overfishing Maine's lucrative and very unique Elver fishery. That was a real flashpoint where there were basically people with, guns going on a reservation to confiscate fishing gear from tribal members. This is some of the examples of what's happened in the past that is fueling this dispute now, and a concern from state regulators, frankly, about how they would have effectively enforced two different types of regulations as it relates to just fishing, you know, and wildlife. That's just one tiny fraction of the issues here, as Mal pointed out. I mean, there's taxation, there's gaming, there's just property. You know, we had people that were testifying last week that live in unorganized territories in this state that are fearful that if this bill were to pass, that they could suddenly be living in a sovereign nation of the tribes, not the state of Maine any longer.
You're going to find yourself in a city, ironically, being occupied by a sovereign nation over which you have no control, which is what we did to the tribes, what someone did to the tribes 300 years ago, 400 years ago. The tribes found themselves occupied by a sovereign nation over which they had no control. It wasn't right then. It's not right now.
This is so complicated and fraught with political consequences that it's going to be very difficult, I think, for lawmakers and the governor to sign off on this particular proposal.
All right. We'll talk more about this in our next Political Pulse. But just briefly before we leave, let's also remind folks that with the presidential primary coming up on March 3rd, there is also another item that will be on the ballot. Steve.
So on March 3rd, in conjunction with the Democratic primary, but you don't need to be a Democrat to vote on this particular issue. It's related to a bill that passed last year that removed all non-medical exemptions from Maine's vaccination law, you know, which basically determines whether or not you can send your kid to school without complying with a schedule of vaccinations. That bill passed in the legislature. There was a people's veto. That is on the ballot. So if you vote yes, you are voting to repeal this new law. If you vote no, you support the law that was passed. There's some confusion about this, which is normal with people's veto because it's almost counterintuitive. You're like, oh, well, if I support something, I want to vote yes. But in this case, you're basically voting no if you want to support the law, not in favor of the people's veto.
Steve and Mal, thank you both very much, as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's a look at Maine's Political Pulse for this week. A reminder, we update the Pulse each Friday afternoon. You can download the entire podcast from mainepublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Most of the Pulse is also on Weekend Edition Sunday on Maine Public Radio, and excerpts of it are also on Monday's Morning Edition. Music is by Rob Holt. Our producer is Willis Ryder Arnold. I'm Erwin Kratz. Thanks for joining us.